Welcome to The Yarn, a school library journal production. I'm Colby Sharp. Today's episode is part of our Unraveler series. In each Unraveler episode, a book creator takes us inside one of their books. Their inspirations, fears, frustrations, triumphs, epiphanies, the whole thing pulled apart, unraveled. In today's episode, I talk to author Dashka Slater about her new book, Accountable, The True Story of a Racist Social Media Account. We talk about where she first heard about this story, how she got the people involved to talk to her, and her hope for the book. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dashka. I'm so excited to be here with Dashka Slater today talking about her new book, Accountable. Dashka, tell us a little bit about this book.
So the book follows the origins and the impacts of a racist social media account that was started at a public high school in the Bay Area. It was started by a Korean-American kid, and the account eventually had 14 followers, including the creator of the account. And so the book looks at the side of the people who created the account or followed the account, and then it looks at the side of the people who were targeted by the account and tries to tell a whole messy, complicated story.
And you open up this book, which I thought was really interesting, with an author's note and content warning. Can you talk a little bit about why you did that and what's in that for the reader?
You know, this is a tough book in a lot of ways. It deals with extremely racist memes and misogyny and suicidal ideas and briefly mentions disordered eating. Like, there's a lot in there. And so I want students in particular to kind of know what they're running into, particularly because this is a book that I hope will be read at school and that teachers will use to open up discussions about really important topics. But I don't want anyone to be blindsided when they encounter the book and the story for the first time.
Can you talk about where you were and what it was like to hear about this story for the first time?
I first heard about this story when I was signing advance copies of The 57 Bus, which is my previous nonfiction narrative, which is also about teenagers and a crime that was charged as a hate crime. So I was not thinking, here's my new beat. I just write about teenagers and hate. But in the signing line, the book wasn't even out yet. Somebody said, did you hear what just happened in Albany? And I had not heard about it. But as this person who was a parent in that school district told me about it, I had a familiar feeling. It was the feeling I had when I first heard about the crime on the 57 bus, which was shock and horror, and then a lot of questions. The first and foremost being, how could this have happened? And as a journalist, that sense of confusion and upset and curiosity all mixed together in this like uncomfortable ball, that is journalistic gold. It means that other people are going to feel the same way. They're going to have all those questions. And I happen to have the ability to get some answers.
So you mentioned that you have experience as a journalist, because I have no idea how you hear about something like this in a signing line, and then years later, it's a 400 plus page book that just, it's exhausting to think about what kind of time must have gone into creating this. Can you talk about like how being a journalist helps you to see a story like this and then eventually turn it into this book? Because there's a lot going on and a lot in it. And I just cannot imagine the work that went into creating this.
I knew from the beginning that I only wanted to write it if I could write from multiple perspectives, the way I had done in 57 Bus. And so a lot of what happens at the beginning is just trying to get people to work with me, because it's a big ask. nobody ever believes how much I'm going to be in their life and for how long. Because what you see on TV is like the reporter flies in, they get the story, they do a stand up in front of the school, and then that's it. But no, I am going to be doing interviews that last hours. There's going to be more than one. I'm going to be following up and following up and following up, and I'll have more questions and I'll circle back. What are you thinking now? And so a lot of what goes into it is first just the I always call it the courtship, where I'm trying to persuade people who are in a pretty traumatized place because either they've been targeted by a racist Instagram account or they are getting the social aftermath of having been a follower or a creator of a racist Instagram account. So try to earn people's trust and show them how I work and what I've done in the past. And then all those hours and hours of interviews. And then in this case, there was also lawsuits. So it was thousands of pages of legal documents to go through and to try and understand some of the legal issues around free speech and hate speech. And then I'm interviewing experts and trying to get some perspective on some of these related issues that had everything to do with, you know, free speech and online radicalization and the science of race. There was a lot of secondary sources that needed to come in as well.
How long were you in this before? Was there like a time where you didn't think it could be a book, or was there a time when you knew it would be a book? Because I just, or did you like instantly know, like, I got this, this is going to be, I just can't imagine what was going through your mind throughout this entire process.
Yeah. So it was the incident happened in 2017. Mm-hmm. In 2019 was when I felt pretty confident that I had a book. So that's a big stretch of time. The first year, pretty much everybody was too traumatized, freaked out, and scared to talk to me. And so it was a lot of doing what research I could in the community, going to public meetings and those kinds of things, and talking to people who were kind of outside but aware, like school board members, people who would give interviews, and waiting, because the answers that I got were not a hard no. They were not ready. And so one of the things I always feel like I bring to the table is a lot of patience. The moment when I knew that I had the story was the moment that I had one person on each side. And I thought, like, that's enough for me. I could tell a story with just two perspectives. That's what I did in the 57 bus. And obviously you pull in other people, but if I have two main characters who can tell the story, that will be enough. And so once I had that, and I that was in 2019, right at the beginning of the year, I had both of those things. And then what surprised me was that all of a sudden the floodgates opened at that moment when I was like, good, I have two. I think I can do this. It'll at least be an article. Maybe it'll be a book. And then suddenly just one person after another agreed to talk to me as well. And soon I had the preponderance of people on both sides.
So was the writing of this book, like in terms of the interviews, was it affected by COVID? Because you're 2019, and then I'm thinking like, well, then we're all in a global pandemic.
Yeah, so that was surprising. Not expected. So I had done a bunch of like about a year's worth of in-person interviews when the pandemic shut everything down. And I had been planning to move much more quickly on the book. And, you know, it was at that point when it was already under contract when we had shut down for COVID. And two things happened. One was that the pandemic made it much harder for people to move on. Like all the kids who were involved on both sides were in some way derailed. Some went on to four-year colleges out of high school. Many, in fact, most did not. They were either not in school at all, or they were in community college and working and trying to figure out what their next move was. And then the pandemic happened and everybody, wherever they were, was kind of sent back to square one. And they were back at home and it was feeling to them a lot like it had felt in the aftermath of the account when either they had been kicked out of school or they had withdrawn from school or they were still in school, but really anxious and depressed and not going very often. And so all of a sudden they're back in their childhood bedrooms, unable, you know, to move on with their lives. And so that meant both that I was concerned about how they were doing and didn't want to rush the book into publication because I didn't want to affect people who were already pretty traumatized and not doing well. But also they had a lot of time to talk. And so, and they were lonely, you know, yeah. That's what we all were. And so I actually had some of my best conversations during like March 2020 was the anniversary. It was the third anniversary of the discovery of the account. And I called everybody to say, like, just it's been 3 years. How are you feeling? What are you thinking about? And it turned out that just people had a lot to say because they were a little bit older and they were reflective and they were also kind of sent back into the experience by the pandemic. And so the year of conversations that I had during lockdown were some of the most interesting ones.
Now, like, when you're writing this as like a journalist, are you like, I'm guessing like you're not trying to like take sides. Like, how are you feeling? Because I would be like, as like an educator, like I don't know how you just are like trying to like hear their side of the story and not like be so mad at people. Like, what was that? I don't understand. Help me understand what that's like as the writer.
Well, one of the privileges of doing this kind of work is that you get people at their most open. And so, you know, I come in and I always tell people, like, you know, I'm not here to judge you. That's not my job. My job is just to hear you tell this story. And it does mean that when people aren't feeling defensive, they often can open up in very appealing ways. And so it wasn't really that hard to feel compassion for most of the people in the book. There are some exceptions, but for most of the people in the book, it was pretty easy because they were young people who were really suffering and had a lot of thoughts and feelings about what they had done. You know, nobody that I interviewed was saying it was nothing. And so, you know, they had varying degrees of insight about what the something was, but all of them understood that it was serious. Mm-hmm. And so that helped me feel connected and compassionate. I think it would have been different if they, you know, had started out with, I don't understand why everybody's so sensitive.
Why do you think they talked to you? Like the kids, especially.
Everybody felt really misunderstood. That was like the one thing that was true of everyone was that they felt like their experience hadn't been understood. So for the girls and one boy who had been targeted, they really felt like people didn't understand both what it was like and why it was such a big deal, because they absolutely were hearing, you know, get over it and, you know, sticks and stones and, you know, why is this still affecting you, you know, 1, 2, 3 years later? So they really wanted to explain what it had been like. And also some of the relationships inside the high school, because of course, like this is a, you know, a big social issue about racism, but it's also a bunch of kids who have relationships with each other, who have known each other, you know, since kindergarten, if not before, and are doing all the high school things and trying to navigate, you know, who gets invited to parties and who you hang out with. And so they often wanted me to understand that set of factors that had been kind of pushed aside in the larger discussion. And then, of course, the people who followed the account felt very misunderstood as well. They felt like people assumed they were a certain kind of person. They wanted to make it clear that they were not that kind of person. They wanted me to understand and tell the story of kind of how this happened and the decisions that they had made and what their friend group was like and why in the moment they hadn't said anything or hadn't thought that it was bad and so on. And I think all of that was because the entire community was so fractured and fragmented and in crisis. And so everybody in town is talking about it and the kids are living it. And they know the story better than anyone, but they don't really, they hadn't had a chance to tell it.
What was something that really surprised you through this whole journey?
There were a couple things. One was certainly just that all of the kids involved were friends. And so, you know, when I walked in, I didn't know that. I thought, you know, this was a group of bullies who had targeted kids they didn't know. So when I understood that these were all kids who had known each other, slept over at each other's houses, that was really astonishing. I was really surprised by the social media piece that the kids who had made and followed the account were living this online life in which edgy memes, transgressive memes, otherwise known as racist or misogynistic, like super offensive memes, were normalized. And so in their online context, what they were doing didn't seem so terrible to them. And then the third, like, really surprising thing was there's this a kid in the book, is John in the book. I met with him at a cafe, intending to do an interview about his experience after he withdrew from school, because I had heard that he had had a really hard time and had had kind of a mental health crisis. So that was what I thought the interview was going to be about. And then in the interview, he took responsibility for the account and said it was really me, and that he had engaged with this scientific racism or race realism. The air quotes are important. but this extremely reprehensible and false pseudoscience that can be found online, which this kid had stumbled into and had absorbed and, you know, swallowed hook, line, and sinker. And I was so not expecting it and also not prepared. I didn't even know about this whole ideology. And so I left the interview and I had to do a whole lot of research to even understood what he had just told me.
What do have the people in the community and the people that are a part of the book, what do they think of it?
It's all over the map. this is a very wounded community. Mm-hmm. And so there's a certain portion of the town that is just feels upset that they are in the news for this again. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, it's very, this whole incident hasn't really been metabolized. The wounds have not healed. And so having it surface again is painful.
Yeah.
For a lot of people who are closer to the story, I've heard many of them just say, like, it meant a lot both to have their story told, but also to learn the things that they didn't know. Because in any incident of this kind, there's no communication between the sides. And mm-hmm. so people construct a narrative in their head about how the other people are doing. And particular in this case, both groups of kids thought the other group was doing fine. Oh. You know, like, they're like, we're the ones who are isolated and suffering. And those other kids, like, they've gone on with their lives and they're fine. And, you know, and I'm sitting there thinking, like, no, nobody's fine. But they didn't know that. So it was helpful to them to just sort of get a larger story and to have some mysteries cleared up. And, you know, then there's also people who, like, don't want to relive it, don't want to read it. Don't, you know, it's just they don't want to go back there. It was, I've had a number of people just say, like, I tried to read it, and people have pretty trauma-based reactions, like shaking, crying, you know, brings up a lot of old stuff.
Would this be a place you would do an author visit?
I'm actually doing one in January.
Oh my gosh. How do you feel about that?
You know, one of the things that I hope, because I am, you know, sort of a Pollyanna, you know, what I want always is to bring healing to places that are hurt. Mm-hmm. And so I hope that the book and the ensuing conversation can be an opportunity for this very wounded community to make some strides towards healing. And that begins, I think, with a full accounting of what happened. You know, that's all truth and reconciliation begins with truth. Yeah. And so I'm hoping that once people hear the whole story and get a sense of the complexity of it, that that will help the community sort of move through this traumatic incident. But I expect there will be some
fireworks.
Emotions. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully not fireworks, but you know, but certainly feelings.
Yeah. What was the hardest part of creating this book?
The hardest part was that I was really worried about the kids. And I felt such an intense sense of responsibility to care for their stories, but also, you know, to make sure that they were not further harmed. And so that meant obviously protecting their identities, but also just trying to be sensitive in the way that I wrote about their experience. So that sense of responsibility, and also just, you know, the conversations were often hard. You know, kids were suffering, and it was, my job is not to fix things. My job is to tell the story. Yeah. But of course, as an adult, when you see kids who are suffering, you want to help them. So that was hard.
What do you think makes a nonfiction book like this? What do you think makes nonfiction reading good or writing good? Like, what makes a great nonfiction book?
A great nonfiction book should read like fiction. It should be 100% accurate and truthful, but it should have all of the techniques that a good novel has. It should have characters that you identify with and that you feel like are lively and that you know. It should have compelling action scenes that make you want to keep reading, and descriptions that are vivid and make you feel like you're there.
There's this part of the book where all of the, like, the kids who were a part of the account are in, like, these meetings with people trying to help them, and all the other kids are like in the hall, like the. And then there's like pizza coming in, and like people are getting all mad. Like, what was it like to write that scene? Because that felt like you had so many people's, like, there was just so much going on. It really felt like I was like in there in that moment.
So that scene is probably like the composite of 40 interviews.
Jeez.
So I, in a book like this, and this was true of 57 Bus as well, I spend way more time outlining than I do writing, because I'm pulling information from so many different places that I have to have a very detailed outline that will say, you know, this bit from this interview, this bit from that interview. And I'm also checking accounts, and where accounts differ, I have to figure out which is the accurate one. So then I'm checking it against another source. And so all of that, and there's legal documents, and I have maps, and, you know, like anything I can to independently verify things, I'm doing that. I have the emails, you know, that day there was a fair amount of correspondence and that I got through a Freedom of Information Act request. And so all of that, it's like a stitching together of many, many different threads.
What is your hope for this book?
I really hope that it opens up conversations about all of these important issues, particularly about what happens online and how it impacts other people. Because I feel like one of the things that happened at this school was that, you know, this was a good school with the classes had taught true history, and they had diversified narratives, and, you know, were reading diverse books and, you know, all the things that we ask for. This was not Florida. And yet kids were not making the connection between the stuff they did online and this history that they had learned, these people that they were in relationship with. And so I hope that my book allows kids to make those connections between what they do online, the stuff they're learning, the people that are around them, so that they can behave better. And also so they can identify some of the dynamics in their friend groups. Because one of the things that we haven't talked about much, but the sort of toxic stuff that can happen among groups of boys that are jockeying for position, I feel like is something that kids all know about, but they don't really know how to look at it as if it's not reality. In other words, obviously it's reality, but it's not the set of social pressures are something that everybody is participating in, but doesn't necessarily feel inside. There's this term pluralistic ignorance, where people believe that everybody else has one position. And even though you individually think, I don't really think that's true, you're not going to say it because you're like, everybody else in the room does think it's true, so I'm not going to be the one. And I think that often happens in groups of kids, but particularly in groups of boys, where everybody's uncomfortable with the level of meanness, of the put downs. You know, people are getting their feelings bruised all the time, but they don't want to be the one who says, like, oh, that's not cool, or I didn't like that, that hurt my feelings. You know, you can just imagine what they feel is going to come their way if they do that. And so I hope that the book brings some air into that social dynamic so that kids can understand, you know, actually, other people find this uncomfortable. There are ways to interrupt it without having to sacrifice your friends, which nobody wants to do.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Yarn. Thank you, Dashka, for taking the time to chat with me. Our theme song was created by author Philip Stead. Additional music for this episode comes from the Free Music Archive. Thank you to Heinemann Publishing for sponsoring this episode, and thank you to my good friend Travis Yonker for helping me to produce and edit this episode. Travis, it's NBA season time. I'm so darn excited. My name is Colby Sharp. Thanks for listening.